Now, achievements and limits of a scientific theory, and with a scientific theory, I mean that is evolutionary biology, and that might be disturbing for some of us, possibly, because I do know Christians, and they would say, well, evolutionary biology, that's not a scientific theory, that's a worldview, isn't it? And this is one of the major points I would like to make clear. Evolutionary biology, in the first place, is a scientific theory. It can be misused within the worldview, and that often happens. But as I'm a biologist, and I'm doing evolutionary research by myself with two of my research groups, evolutionary biology, in the first place, is a scientific theory, and a scientific theory means the outcome is open. You can test parts of the scientific theories. Scientific theories will be maybe able to explain scientific data, but it may happen that they are not able to explain certain data. So as a scientist, I'm just open in my approach, and I want to know what are the achievements, what is the potential, and what is the limit of evolutionary biology as a scientific theory. In the first part of my lecture, I will just give you a very short overview about the empirical part of evolutionary biology. You will see there is an empirical part of that theory, and then there are other parts of that theory which are not directly empirical. So the empirical part is molecular biology and population genetics, to make a long story pretty short. And the molecular biology would try to tell us which are the factors which cause new genetic variants to arise in individuals. So there are many such factors. You probably all know mutation, recombination is another one, hybridization is another one, horizontal gene transfer, and some other factors in addition. So these create variation. Charles Darwin didn't know the molecular nature of these factors, but he observed variation. You can observe variation everywhere in nature. And then we have the level of population genetics, and this is the science which calculates and observes the change of the frequency of the genetic variants in the population, which means, basically spoken, if I do carry a special variant which might potentially be beneficial for my survival of my descendants, so increases my fitness, that does only play a role in evolution if this variant is transferred to many other descendants and finally would dominate the population more or less. So this is population genetics, and you can calculate such processes, at least in principle. It's extremely difficult if it goes into the details. And now, the processes which fix these genetic variants in the populations is Darwinian evolution. You all know selection, so that is one observable process. Another process is migration or isolation, which would change species. Then we have a very important part, I'm not going to talk about that, of population genetics, that is neutral evolution, that is genetic drift, and there may be others we don't know. That's a possibility. We all should take into account the possibility that there are many things we don't know. Now, such factors are known to cause variation, and I would say they are also able to cause speciation. So species might arise on the basis of these factors we can observe, and there are many, many examples. You all know the Darwin finches, which probably go back to an ancestor which arrived from South America on the Galapagos Islands. So there's a very old example. There are many, many more recent examples. For instance, we have good reasons to assume that all these different monkeys of the genus Cercopithecus would belong to one type. Actually, almost all of them are able to hybridize, which is a very good criterion that they are very, very similar genetically. And I believe that evolutionary theory is able to explain, in principle, such observations. And the first key message is that evolution can be observed everywhere in biology. I'm a microbiologist, I can observe evolutionary processes in the laboratory. And second, that the capability to evolve is a most fundamental characteristic of life. And what I'm talking about right now still is the process we call microevolution. And how far that process reaches, that is a matter of discussion. Now, saying this, I say this as a scientist, as a biologist, and if I just change the level of argument, because I'm also a Christian, but that is not what I say as a scientist. As a Christian, I would say that this capability to variation and this capability to evolve is something God has put into his creation. So that's something what I believe as a Christian. Now, there are many other theories of in evolutionary biology. Many of them are based on comparative biology, the similarities of the different life forms, and often these similarities are gradual, sometimes they aren't, and they are observable at different levels, from the DNA to behavior of organisms. And evolutionary theory in total assumes that these similarities usually, there may be exceptions, usually are due to common descent. Convergence is another idea. And if you leave the scientific realm, you may say perhaps these similarities occur by design. But in saying so, you are not making an argument from an empirical scientist's or biologist's view, although that may be true. There are many unsolved questions. I have no time to go into detail and just give you another idea. Theories in evolutionary biology may be historical approaches to evolution, from paleontology, from biostratigraphy, and all the questions of the age of the earth, radiometric dating come into play here. So biostratigraphic and paleontological data provide evidence for macroevolutionary change, which means they can be interpreted in this way. But in this field also many problems are unsolved. You all have heard from the missing links problem. So that is something which has to be shown in the future what happens to this problem. And there are other theories within evolutionary biology which I'm not going to talk about right now. I say this because I would make it clear that data which we find in biology can be interpreted within a framework of evolutionary thinking, without being dogmatic, without using a worldview. It's just a way of interpreting the data, which may be right or may be wrong. That's what I state as a scientist. Second part of my talk is to introduce you to some of the potential of Darwinian evolution. You saw Darwinian evolution, that's just one part of the potential to change. But it's an important part, and I think Darwin was an intelligent man, and he discovered an important aspect which can be observed in nature. I can tell you that we observe this Darwinian evolution, the principles of Darwinian evolution. We observe it almost in every experiment we do as microbiologists in the lab. On a very, very small scale, but in principle, that's what we can observe daily. And Darwinian evolution is an evolution which goes that way, that you have some sort of information, of biological information. You change that information, for instance, using a mutation, and then selection acts. And if the mutation was beneficial, then you would get population dynamic laws would make this variation dominate. And this can happen with a single point mutation, and the idea is that it can happen successively. Many different mutations would come one after the other, and Richard Dawkins illustrated this finding by using this nonsense sentence. It's not a sentence, it's a nonsense sequence of characters. And these characters, he wrote a computer program, and these characters, let these characters change. And then he had in mind a target sentence. And if a new mutation fits the target sentence, he keeps that mutation, and then he lets this system run for a couple of generations, 50 or 43 generations, and at the end of the day you get a sequence which makes sense. So this illustrates the principle of Darwinian evolution, although this example has many, many problems. You start with nonsense. I will tell you, in Darwinian evolution, you need to start with sense, not with nonsense. That's point number one. Point number two is, he had a sentence in mind, evolution has not. But still the principle is very clearly marked. Because we could now take that principle, mutations, replication, selection, and so on, and use this strategy to engineer machines, for instance, to design new macromolecules. That is always the same principle. You have an initial function, you change that function, you measure what it does, and then you get a new function. So you can produce shapes of wings of an aircraft, which will, at the end of the of this mutational process, which will have a shape, which is pretty difficult to predict by mathematics, but an evolutionary optimization function will create things which obviously look as if they were designed. That is something you can observe in an engineering technique, and there is an entire methodology in engineering to optimize structures this way. So this shows, under certain circumstances, there is a creative potential, a design potential in the Darwinian mechanism. And now I could show you examples which demonstrate this also if you use DNA or RNA or proteins, which replicate, which mutate, which are selective, you can show the same principle is at work in living cells. And it may produce things you would look at and you'd say, well, that looks as it is if designed. So I skip this example for time reasons. It's an evolutionary design of a ribosome, which looks pretty complex. It's an RNA molecule which can catalyze an enzymatic reaction, joins to RNA molecules. And you can do that, and if you look at the end product of this thing, you might say, well, that looks like design. Perhaps there was a creator who made it, but it was not. So, of course, there are circumstances in that experiment which come from the human mind, but it is well imaginable that something would also come into existence in a cell, in a living cell. Now, I'll just skip this argument. I don't have the time to explain that. The take-home key message is that first, microevolution is implemented in the very basic molecular structure of life. I think this is meaningful. This is important. And I think that Darwinian principle is a powerful evolutionary mechanism. By way of this cumulative evolution, it is even able to produce structures which represent novel biological information. And such structures may appear as if they were designed. So for many Christians, that's difficult to accept. But I do think this is just what we observe. The question is, how far does this process take us? Is this the process which can explain what we see in nature today? But I would like to add, if you are active in discussions in this field, I would like to add that I believe it is not a sign of weakness if we as Christians appreciate the strength of an argument of our opponents. I mean, this is a tough discussion. Evolution, creation, that's a tough discussion. I could talk a lot about this tough discussion from my personal experience. But I have learned that it is not a sign of weakness to accept that the other side has a strong argument. I think it's even an indication of, of superiority, if you like. Now, there are certain prerequisites for a design by Darwinian evolution to occur. That does not occur everywhere. There are clear boundaries for this process to occur, and these boundaries are first in life. In cells, you need biomolecular machines which store and transmit biological information. You need replication, transcription, and translation. And these biomolecular machines need to be constructed from monomers which allow variable redundant structure in order to make them evolvable. So even the choice of amino acids, even the choice of the genetic code is responsible for such sort of evolutionary variation. And you need that, otherwise the process would not run. And then, of course, you would need a cellular environment, including all sorts of low molecular weight metabolites and compartments in order to make that process work. In other words, the prerequisite for design by Darwinian evolution is the existence of life itself. You need at least an initial cell which works in the way life works today. You need biological information, you need biological information transfer at all sorts of level in life. So that is a prerequisite to make that work. And if that prerequisite is present, and I just would like to call this prerequisite primary design, because I don't see a way how that could come into existence by natural processes. I don't see a way. Does not mean that there is no way. Just I don't see one, and I can give you reasons, but I would not be able to say this is 100% true. Now, the origin of primary design structures such as a cell is unknown, and biological structures produced by this Darwinian mechanism, I understand these as to represent secondary design, and that is dependent on primary design. I find this a helpful distinction in that entire discussion. Now, these are the prerequisites you need in order to make Darwinian evolution work, but there are also limits of evolutionary change, as far as we can tell today from empirical data. So that's always what I'm referring to, limits of evolutionary change you can tell from empirical data. You must always have an initial function. That's what Dawkins' sentence doesn't. You always need initial biological functions, if you will, a purpose at the first place. And then Darwinian evolution is a process which optimizes such existing structures. It does not create novel structures. For that you need other mechanisms. And then you need a smooth fitness landscape. Fitness landscape concept is complicated. I can't go into detail here. In principle, what it says, a smooth fitness landscape, it says if you have one mutation, or may even be two or three at a time, then the mutants will have a better fitness. They will be able to have more descendants as the wild type also. So that is an increased fitness. And you need a fitness landscape which is smooth, which says very, very little change would produce a fitter descendant. And if that is the case, and you have, so this is just a picture, this is a two-dimensional fitness landscape. Real fitness landscapes are n-dimensional, and n is a large number. So, but that is a complicated issue. Now, if you move up such a hill, and that is Mount Improbable, from Richard Dawkins calls that Mount Improbable, if you move up such a hill, yes, you can move up such a hill. And you can produce astonishingly different structures using this process. But the fitness landscape needs to be smooth. And there are reasons to believe, and I will give you one example later on, that fitness landscapes sometimes are smooth, yes, but sometimes they appear to be rugged. They appear to be discontinuous. And if that is the case, the Darwinian mechanism gets problems. So you see here, you can move up that slope, no problem, but you will have difficulties to move up that cliff. So that cliff, that means you need many mutations in the same organism, accumulating in the same organism, and only if all of these come together, you will have the initial function. There will be a cliff in a fitness landscape. And I will show you one example where I believe that such a cliff exists. Now, macroevolution is a process which is said to have caused the existence of all what we see. All living cells go back to a single cell, and I would think almost all contemporary evolutionary biology asserts that all biological structures observed today are the result of, in my terminology, secondary design. So life looks as if it is designed, but in reality it's a result of an evolutionary process. And I hope you can understand now the argument. If you try to put yourself into the perspective of an evolutionary biologist, that you can understand why is he thinking so. And I think that is important. I think as Christians we should try to understand why are other people think in a way they think. And only if we understand that, we can communicate properly with them. And I also wish, that an atheist biologist would try to understand why I think in a specific way. So this is my desire, that we would be able to talk and to communicate on such a level. Unfortunately, that turns out to be very, very difficult for a variety of reasons. Well, important questions are unsolved in evolutionary biology, and I will show you one such question, which I think is unresolved. I will give one example, which comes from the macroevolutionary changes, which we must assume if we think that the biomolecular machines of the cell evolve. A biomolecular machine, that is either a single protein or a couple of different proteins which work together in a concerted action. That we call, and this machine, this produces, well, work, so to speak, produces work. And all our cells are full, packed full with such astonishing machines, and these are fundamental for life. And actually they need information to be built, biological information to be built. And only these devices are able to transform energy into order. Now, I'll give you a few examples for such machines just in order to give you an idea how they look like. So this is a sketch of the DNA replication in a bacterium. And this DNA replication is made. Actually, several biological machines work together over here. So this is the replicase complex, the DNA polymerase 3 in bacteria. And I'll come to that back later. And then we have a molecular machine which would split the double-strand DNA into single strands. And then you have a machine which despirals the DNA strand. So these are many different machines which are working together, and the molecular structure of some of those is known. So the DNA clamp is one part of this machine. It fixes the DNA polymerase on the DNA molecule and enhances processivity about 1,000-fold. It requires a helper protein called clamp loader. So it's the cooperative action of different enzymes. You can see here the protein which folds around the DNA. It's composed of several subunits here, DNA in the center. And so that's part of of the DNA synthesis capacity of the cell, or you can see here the DNA helicase, which is also such a machine, and that machine that separates the two DNA strands into single strands, which is needed in order to make DNA. This is the helicase, and it rotates with about 1,000 RPM. It's pretty fast. And this complex is made of six monomers, six times 470 amino acids in principle. Another biological machine or biomolecular machine is the flagellum, and I use this example because it has been used so many times in the ID discussion in the United States and elsewhere in the world, so I use that machine also. It's a rotary machine, and this rotary machine propels the bacterium. In this case, it's best studied in Salmonella and in E. coli, and you can see here a sketch of a machine. It's an axis and it's different parts which fix the machine in the cell wall of the bacterium, and a hook structure which fixes the propeller, so to speak, at the machine. And this machine is rotating. It's the length of the bacterium is pretty small, 2 micrometers. So if you have 500 bacteria in one row, it's 1 millimeter. The length of the filament is 10 micrometers. So length of the motor is 30 nanometers. You need 35,000 motors to make 1 millimeter. And the equipment of the cell in the case of E. coli is up to 15 motors per cell. The operating voltage, which is the membrane potential, is 25 to 200 millivolts, and it has a speed up to 100,000 RPM. Not in E. coli, I should add. This is a sodium-driven motor, and the speed up to 100 micrometer per second. So this is 50 times the length of the cell per second. If you move a car 50 times the length of the car per second, you will get about 800 kilometer per hour. So you can't do that in Sweden. You can't do that in Poland, but you can do it in Germany. So you don't have speed limits on our autobahn. Yeah, as it's an amazing structure. It's an amazing structure, and I will go through it just very, very fast. So this is a reconstruction, a biophysical reconstruction, which shows some of the features of that motor. So this is the motor axis about here, and these are the motor elements composed of several proteins, and the whole thing is driven by a proton transport across the cytoplasmic membrane. I'll skip this one. And the motor is composed of many, many different proteins which have a highly defined three-dimensional structure. Many different motors exist, actually. I don't know how many different types of motors, variants of motors exist. Millions, probably. Millions or more than millions. Probably as many as bacterial species, and nobody knows how many these are. Well, but the principle in the motor structure is always the same. So that is a certain three-dimensional structure in the motor. That is the flagellum protein. Don't go into detail, it just gives you an impression the thing is complicated. And nobody would assume that the motor just comes into existence with a big bang, so to speak. But the motor must have evolved in different small steps. And one idea to understand the evolution of the motor is that the motor today has very, very many different functions. You can see here a proton channel, type 3 secretion machine, an ATPase, an adhesion, and more than that, it's not the only one. It's more than these functions. Now, the evolution of the flagellum has been separated into different steps by one scientist, that is a publication in the internet. The idea is you divide that in very, very many different steps. And then if you divide it in very many different steps, each step may have a reasonable probability to come into existence. And you can go into detail, and I have done so in pretty much detail, actually, and I have focused on only one of these steps, which has been proposed by Nick Matzke in the evolution of the bacterial flagellar motor. And this is a step where an adhesion protein would fix to an initial primitive secretion machine. So that is one, and that is a co-option process. That is called co-option. pretty good idea. Now, that is the protein which is secreted, and if you have co-option mutation, that means that the protein is now fixed to the secretion machine, and it's changed in its structure to bind to the machine, to the secretion machine, and also to adhere to some surface somewhere else. So this is a co-option process. What you need is mutations to form the new adhesion domain. You need mutations to form a coupling domain, and you need mutations to stabilize the altered secretion system. And you can ask, what kind of mutations would you probably need, and what should these probably change in these structures? So I always go to the detail. I'm not satisfied with just so stories. As an experimental biologist, I would like to know the details, even if they are hypothetical. That's fine with me. We cannot make experiments for everything. So you can make a list of the different things which probably need to happen, and my argument here is based on what we know about the variability, about what we need to have if we produce an adhesion protein, and so on and so on, and just go through it very rapidly. So this is a table of things which should happen in order to make an adhesion protein which is secreted in order to fix this to the secretion machine. The idea you should get it, if you just investigate this only small step, you get quite a number of changes you probably would need in order to make this single event happen in the evolution of a motor. It's much speculation with that analysis, much speculation, because we know very little. But still, what I can see at the point of the knowledge we have now, and that is our restriction, is that this would appear to be some sort of a cliff in a fitness landscape, and I told you it's an n-dimensional fitness landscape, that is important. So we need quite a couple of changes, and it appears to be unknown how these may accumulate in a bacterium, just to make this one step, whether this one step would be selectively positive, whether this one step would bring the bacterium in the right direction, is doubtful. But that's another argument, and I cannot make that here. So basically what I would say is we know very little about the evolution of bacterium flagellum. So that's actually the argument. And I show you here that very small blue part, which is shown here, that is what we know based on the molecular evolutionary processes which can be observed in the laboratory. And that is what we not know about the bacterial motor. This is a knowledge gap in evolutionary biology. We have not explained how such a thing comes into existence. So the question is design the best explanation? Now you say, well, we don't have explained this. Now that was a creator. That was the designer. Is that a reasonable, convincing conclusion? I think it's not, as a scientist. I might think this is a good idea as a Christian, but as a scientist, this is not an explanation for me, for several reasons. And one reason is that the current knowledge on microbial genetics and protein biochemistry is very small. It's about that above here. And what we potentially could know, maybe in 50 years' time, in 100 years' time, I don't know, there's much, 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 much more. I think as biologists, we are scratching at the surface of what could be known. So that much isn't known. That much isn't known. Perhaps the solution for this problem, which I just explained to you, perhaps the solution is still to be discovered. Perhaps. And I cannot exclude that, and I don't want to. Well, as a scientist, I cannot exclude it. As a Christian, I don't want to exclude it. Because I think that the basis of our belief lies somewhere else. Now we go through this slides very fast, otherwise I will shortly get a signal that I have to stop to speak if I see my clock correctly. So what we do have, in science is an empirical method, and this empirical method we always work with, this empirical method, this says, well, if we can, we try to make it without a supernatural intervention. If we try to can. I never made any supernatural intervention in my theories, in my laboratory. I never made that, and probably I never will. That has something to do with the art, with the way nature works. Now we go back, to the history and ask, where does life come from? And there also is the first choice, I believe, the idea that in the past processes observed today have been active, and we believe, as biologists, in the first choice, that no intelligent design mechanism has acted in the past. Macroevolution, including the evolution of the bacterial flagellum, is not an observable, reproducible phenomenon. It's definitely no. It's a succession of numerous, presumed, singular historical events. It can therefore not be investigated by empirical science, strongly by empirical science. So which method should we use to investigate these processes? My proposal is that is the most obvious, most reasonable null hypothesis for a biologist, an empirical historical approach. An empirical historical approach which includes the non-interventionalist assumption. I believe it's not intelligent design. As a biologist, I'm a biologist, so I speak as a biologist in the first place. It's natural for a biologist to assume that things have gone the way they go today. So why should we, how should we investigate natural history, microevolution? We can observe microevolutionary processes today, empirically. There are evolutionary mechanisms which appear to be able to create some novel biological information that is observable. Many features of life show that organisms are very similar, probably related. We can check that experimentally if we look in short-term history. We have the fossil record, geological data, radiometric data. And in a non-interventionalistic approach today, which has been extremely successful. I mean, look at what exists today, what science, what empirical science has accomplished. And also we have Occam's razor, so the principle of parsimony, which says, if we have causes which are sufficient, why should we introduce some other additional causes? So this idea leads a biologist who thinks in the approved system of empirical and empirical historical methodology that it's the obvious null hypothesis is descended by natural modification and definitely not intelligent design. You may not share this view, but I think it's important for you to understand this view. I can understand it perfectly well. Now, the null hypothesis of evolutionary biology may well turn out to be inadequate to explain certain biological structures. That is a possibility. And I think that all biologists should keep in mind that this null hypothesis may even be wrong at the end of the day. That is a possibility which a scientist, an empirical scientist, must keep in mind. If you have a worldview which is a materialistic worldview, you won't keep that in mind. But that's not a thing of science. And this null hypothesis makes sense of many data. Yes, it does. But it has also produced significant evolutionary knowledge gaps. We don't know so much. What to do with knowledge gaps? Well, we have such knowledge gaps, and I would say in the first place, do research in order to close these knowledge gaps. Do go back to the lab, try it again. Evolutionary research, and as a Christian, I myself do evolutionary research, and I think we should do much more evolutionary research, much more than we do. But we have not got enough money. So sometimes the problems, the gaps can be closed, and then we would say, well, evolution is a satisfying explanation. Sometimes a solution cannot be found, and what we do and what I do with my students, they don't find a solution, and usually I say, well, go back to the lab. Try again, try it another way. You may find solution if you work harder, if you try to go novel ways. And sometimes the problem becomes more serious the more you work. So we have such cases, not only in historical sciences, but also in the lab. And then we have something which I call a non-trivial knowledge gap. A non-trivial knowledge gap. It is obvious that the ways we try to solve the problems up to now does not work. So we need something else. We need more. Still, an evolutionary solution may exist, be it the molecular motor, be it the biomolecular machines, the origin of the first cell, it may exist. It may not exist. That's another possibility. But if it exists, we might discover it. But it's a possibility that a solution exists and we cannot discover it for methodological reasons. That's also a possibility. So if a solution does not exist, it's difficult to prove. Because you always say, wait another 10 years, wait another 20 years. At the end of the day, you will get the solution. And if you look at what we discovered in biology in the last years, it's tremendous. So it's difficult to make an argument out of that. Of course, we all have firm convictions. The Christians have firm convictions, and the evolutionary biologists have also firm convictions, and most of my colleagues have a very firm conviction that they say, yes, there is a solution. Even if you don't know it, there is a solution. So this is a conviction. Nobody knows. You believe that. That's perfectly okay. Try to solve the problem. Behind that may be a naturalistic faith. Matter and energy explains everything. But you may also have such a firm conviction as a theistic evolutionary biologist. That is also a possibility. It's perfectly okay. We need to make clear this is not something science has demonstrated. This is something we expect for a variety of reasons. And we can have a firm conviction that the evolutionary solution does not exist, in principle does not exist. And that is the theistic faith, ID, creationism, you call it different ways. Unfortunately, there are also fundamentalist ideologies coupled to these convictions. In two cases, there are fundamentalist ideologies in evolutionary biology, evolutionism. So often, some of these people say, there is no problem. They just deny that there is any problem. Sometimes theistic evolutionists also behave this way. I know a couple of those. Not all of them, of course, but many different ones. And on the other hand, there are also fundamentalist ideology among Christians. Unfortunately, I'm afraid many. So some would even say quit evolutionary research since it's futile anyway. And fundamentalism can go even farther. Some Christians say evolutionists are idiots. Kind of idiots. I've heard that. But some evolutionists also would say believe in God are insane. I've heard that too. You also, just reading some book covers. Now it's a poisoned discussion. It's a poison discussion. Back to the question, knowledge gaps of evolutionary biology, are they a firm basis for faith in God? My personal, you need not to share this answer. You can have different approaches to that. My personal answer is no. So what you see here, I don't have time to go into detail, this is a picture of one of the former gods in Germany, Thor, or Donau in Germany, has the hammer, and the weather is made, and thunder, and so on. So that God has died out because we have explained what he did. This is a very short argument, and I know we can discuss about that. This is a very short argument, but in principle, it is what I wanted to say. I believe that God does not reside in the knowledge gaps of evolutionary biology. God does not reside in the knowledge gaps of humankind's anybody. Because if he would, we would have God boxed in into our intellectual capabilities if we could make a final argument. And I think we can't. Nevertheless, it is possible that we can realize in looking to nature that God exists. We can. So Romans says so. What may be known about God is plain to everybody, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. So Romans 1, it's a very clear statement, isn't it? Very, very clear statement. So is it possible to recognize God from nature? It's possible. In Psalm 19, verses 1 to 4, it says, "The beauty of life declares the glory of God, and biomolecules proclaim the work of his hand. Day after day they pour forth speech, night after night they reveal knowledge. They have no speech, they use no word, no sound is heard from them, yet their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the end of the world." Nature talks. Nature talks. It has a language. So Kepler refers to mathematics being the language of God. Francis Collins refers to DNA as being the language of God. Chemists may refer to other things, maybe the periodic system, to be the language of God. I agree to all three points of view. But I agree to these points of view as being non-scientific positions of faith. Not scientific ones. You know, the language of science is not what I believe, which the Apostle Paul refers to. Well, in the first place, he did not know these languages. He was not a chemist, he was not a physicist, he was not a biologist. These languages are part of the system which we have today. And more than that, they are part of a system which excludes God in his methodology, which is appropriate because I do also in my research. So this is not the language of physics, chemistry, and biology. But still, some of the results of empirical science, of empirical biological research, raise questions. They raise questions which reach way beyond the limits of biology and science. But these questions cannot be answered by using these approaches. And these are the questions which my students have in mind if I show them the bacterial motor, if I show them bits from the movies, from the replication machinery. They look at that, and that raises questions in their minds, which cannot be answered using science. I believe that nature speaks a second language, which is not the language of empirical science. And this language has no words, and it has no sound, no formulas, no algorithms, no natural laws you need to learn, and still its voice goes out into all the earth. Their words reach the ends of the world. You need no chemistry. You need no study physics or biology to understand this language. Every human being can understand this language. Isn't this fair? Really fair? Everybody on this world is able to understand something of this language. Because because it's understood by the human heart, by something which is much deeper embodied in our souls than empirical science ever can be. In my mind, my conviction, this is a full-blown revelation which God provides in His creation. Yes, God speaks through nature. Nature even provides a breathtaking encounter with the eternal one. And even atheists give testimony that this is real. They talk about the wonders of nature. They talk about the ingenious and sophisticated construction and even creations of nature. You can go through the biological literature and can see this. As Paul puts it, nobody has an excuse. Well, man can choose whether to listen to what his heart is saying to him. Man can choose not to listen. I think to a certain degree God has made us free to respond. Because God has made us free to respond, at the end of the day it appears to be true what the author of Hebrews said. By faith we understand that the universe was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible. For me personally, that has to do with my personal history as a Christian also. I've gone through different stages. I started as an atheist, then I become a creationist. And then I changed from a creationist and from a young earth creationist. And, well, I ended up today and, what shall I say, the first lecture in this conference from this psychiatrist. But what was the title of that lecture? Who are you think you are? Something like that. So, well, I don't know where I will end up. So, but I do know that by faith I can understand that the world is created. And to me, it's very obvious. So thank you for your attention.